Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book of the collection, 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on chapter 26, and this is the 18th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner. And there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 26. Exciting Fishing Experiences and The Devil in the Cockpit and A Luxurious Breakfast and Rodriguez Island and The Effects of a Cyclone. Calms, as a rule, are considered unwelcome visitors to sailing vessels, but as almost everything on board had become wet, we appreciated the change of weather, which afforded us an opportunity to dry things. On that warm, sunny day, we lowered all sail and hung our wet garments about the deck and rigging, which made the Tilikum look more like a floating Chinese laundry than a sailing vessel. Thereupon, we spread an awning over the cockpit and, devoting our energies to a comfortable smoke, we took the world easy. While thus resting, stretched out on the seats of the cockpit, we observed a flying fish crossing over our heads. Getting up, we found ourselves surrounded by a school of these fish, chased by dolphin fish. The latter showed great skill in pursuit. Taking long reaches, they were right on the spot to seize their prey whenever one was compelled to drop into the water, its wings becoming dry after an extended flight. Flying fish had become very common on our daily bill of fare, but dolphins had so far never entered the galley of the Tilikum. So many leaping about tempted us to get out our fishing gear to secure one for home consumption. Dolphin fish are caught in much the same way as salmon or bonito. In either case, the boat sails through the water, while a long line with a hook and a white rag attached to the end is kept trawling over the stern, when the dolphin will mistake the rag for a fish. On large vessels, I have also on different occasions caught dolphin fish as well as bonitos by means of a line similarly prepared but attended from the jib boom while the ship was travelling at a good speed. On this occasion, with the Tilikum lying motionless but for a lazy roll caused by the ocean swell, the dolphin fish devoted their attentions to the flying fish and completely ignored our fishing gear. It was shortly after sunset and the beautiful tropical stars twinkled overhead. The dolphin fish had abandoned the chase and were indolently swimming about the boat. Now and then, one would roll over on its side as if to turn in for the night. While sitting in the cockpit, I noticed a fat fellow in that attitude within easy reach, and thinking that I could master him, I grabbed his tail to pull him aboard. In this, however, I was much mistaken. No sooner did I touch him than he dealt me such a blow with his tail that it reminded me of an electric shock. I was only too willing to let go, and off he went like a shot. About 8 o'clock, when I had retired to the cabin and Mac was still flirting with a dolphin fish, I suddenly heard heavy splashes, followed by a tremendous noise in the cockpit. My mate sang out, "What is this? What is this? I have caught the very devil himself." Out on deck I went like a flash, and there found Mac, scared to the top of the cabin deck, keeping well out of the way of something struggling in the cockpit, nearly smashing in the floor in an attempt to escape. Owing to the darkness, I was unable to identify the noisy stranger, but on getting a light, I quickly recognised a young shark, about 3.5 feet in length, making desperate use of his tail. In accordance with seaman's etiquette, the world over, we dispatched him and threw the body overboard. The incident had resurrected our hunting spirit. Dolphin fish were still hovering about, and as all other means had failed, we decided to rig a spear. For this purpose, we employed a combination of a boat hook, a knife, and a spike, and Father Mac, who claimed to be an expert spearsman, took the matter in hand. When the next dolphin turned over within reach, he succeeded in sending the spear through his body and pulled him aboard. We hung up the prize in the mizzen rigging for the night, and the following morning our bill of fare consisted of cream of wheat with cream, fresh fried dolphin fish, hot biscuits with New Zealand butter and coffee, quality number one, and such was our breakfast after being 58 days at sea. Now, you landlubbers, do you think you can beat that? On that day, we had dolphin for breakfast, dinner and supper, and still there was a good piece left for consumption the next morning. During the day, a light breeze came up from the southeast and we proceeded on our course. The following morning, the remainder of the fish, though it felt somewhat flabby, smelt and looked quite good, and as our boat was going at a good speed and the chances of catching another dolphin fish were small, we cooked what was left and thoroughly enjoyed it. Soon after, however, I was taken bad with pains in my stomach and also felt a slight headache. My mate complained of a similar indisposition, which with both of us rapidly increased. My head throbbed terribly and felt as if it were likely to split. There was little doubt that the fish had turned without our noticing it. We had made a good meal and now were suffering from the effects of fish poison. In such a case, if quick action be not taken, death may be the consequence. Remembering well the excellent service the Mustard had done in a similar case on Wessel Island, without delay, we hove the boat to and lit the stove. The mixture was soon ready, and each swallowed his share, which promptly relieved us of all pain. However, feeling still weak, we remained hove to all forenoon, and at midday partook of a light meal only, consisting of cream of wheat and a cup of tea. This made us feel better and enabled us to resume our voyage an hour later. The same night we had a substantial supper, after which we felt fully recovered. By that time, we were within 400 miles of Rodriguez. The southeaster kept blowing fresh, and on the morning of November the 28th, we sighted the island. In the afternoon, when approaching the southeastern end, seeing quite a number of fishing craft going in towards the land, we followed them. By and by, we entered the coral reefs, by which part of Rodriguez is surrounded, and soon dropped anchor among the fishing boats, which had arrived just beforehand. When our anchor was down, several fishermen boarded us. They spoke French, and Mac, who had a good knowledge of that language, soon talked some fine living fish out of them, which we cooked for supper. Having finished our meal, we were invited ashore by the fishermen, who numbered about 40 in all. They had a camp which consisted of a few roughly built houses along the beach, where they slept whenever time did not admit of the walk to their homes, which were some distance away in the town on the northern end of the island. To the latter place we sailed the following morning, and on arrival made fast to a small wharf. A little later, the magistrate of Rodriguez came aboard to acquaint himself with the particulars of our voyage. On invitation, I accompanied him to his house, Mac staying aboard and, with him and his family, spent a pleasant day. In the course of the afternoon, while we were sitting on the spacious veranda, talking on various subjects, a gentleman stepped up to me and said, "Are you Captain Voss of the Tillicum?" I affirmed the question when the stranger introduced himself as the manager of the British cable station, and at the same time he handed me a cablegram which read, "Tell Captain Voss to send that cake." "What is the meaning of this, sir?" I inquired. The manager explained that he had been on board the Tillicum, where my mate, amongst other things, had recited him the history of the New Zealand fruitcake and its unforeseen, though glorious, end. In possession of this news, he had at once cabled to his colleague on the Cocos Keeling Islands, with the result that the indignant consignee sent back the above stern demand. The gentleman evidently found it difficult to suppress a smile when adding that he had further received instructions to immediately take steps for recovering the cake. "Now, what are you going to do about it?" he asked. To reproduce a cake which had been consumed head and tail a fortnight previously was certainly impossible. And so I gave a short explanation why we did not reach the Cocos Keeling Islands, despite all our efforts and of the troubles encountered in the Indian Ocean, not forgetting, in conclusion, to praise the high quality of the subject under discussion. And finally, I asked the manager to express my regret to the consignee and transmit him my apology. Both gentlemen had a hearty laugh, and we all agreed that the matter was settled. A short time previous to our arrival, a cyclone had visited the island, leaving considerable devastation in its track. My host said that it had been the worst on record on Rodriguez. A flagstaff had been erected near the magistrate's residence, made of hardwood, 9 inches in diameter and measuring 30 feet from the ground to the crosstrees, where it was stayed with 4 strong wires. But the force of the hurricane had snapped it at the middle like a piece of glass. On my inquiring about the velocity of the wind, the manager of the cable station informed me that he had no record, as his anemometer together with the building in which it was mounted near the station, had been blown to pieces and scattered so thoroughly that he was unable afterwards to recover any of the fragments. Iron pillars that supported the roof of the veranda at the cable station were broken and houses razed to the ground. Much damage had been done all over the island. If the cyclone had struck you in your little vessel, the manager added, you would never have lived to tell the tale. I'm not so sure about that, I replied. I think our risks on the open sea would not have been any greater than yours on the island here, with broken flagstaff, pieces of iron pillars, houses, trees and other heavy material flying about your ears. On the second and last day before our departure, I went on an exploring excursion. Rodriguez is a high and not too fertile island, extending about 12 miles from east to west and 6 from north to south. The population aggregated about 3,000 and consisted chiefly of Africans, intermingled with settlers of French origin and some mixed descendants. Cattle, beans, saltfish and goats form the principal articles of export. My mate and myself were honoured with a dinner at the cable station, and on the next morning a mass was read in the Catholic Church, out of regard to my mate, for a successful voyage. Thereafter, we set sail for Durban. Chapter 27. Another miscalculation, an meagre Christmas dinner, and sad news received at Durban, and unexpected vindication and meeting of an old friend, and the Tillicum as a mountain climber. We made a good start, with a fresh southeasterly breeze, and in 52 hours were near the south end of the island of Mauritius. We sailed close enough to the shore to obtain a good view of some of the great sugar plantations for which Mauritius is famous. Cane fields of a beautiful green hue came almost down to the shore, being planted on a gradually inclining sweep of land which extended to a considerable height. Here and there, comfortable homesteads, surrounded by trees and gardens with an occasional windmill, were interspersed, which lent a prosperous aspect to the landscape. There is a splendid harbour on the northwestern coast, and the population numbers nearly 400,000. I felt a strong inclination to call there, but being short of time, kept on our course for Durban. The southeasterly trade wind stayed with us until we reached a position 50 miles south of Madagascar, when it became very light and gradually hauled into the southwest. The following 2 days we drifted about and at times were becalmed in sight of the great French island. There is a saying that a lull precedes a storm, but on this occasion we obtained a moderate northeasterly breeze instead, with which we approached the South African coast in fine weather. It was only a few days before Christmas, and the wind being fresh and fair, while the distance to Durban was not more than 150 miles, we wanted to make sure of spending the approaching festival on terra firma. On December the 22nd, we had the coast of Natal in sight, and at noon, Durban was yet 75 miles away. The nor'easter sent the Tillicum along almost at top speed, and we got things ready for entering the port. An hour later, the wind increased to such an extent that we were compelled to take in some of our sail. The sky looked clear, and the land seemed to grow in proportion to our hopes. Roast beef and plum pudding and a small or perhaps a large bottle of wine will be my Christmas dinner, said Mac in jubilation. Just then I noticed a small dark cloud rising in the southwest and promptly advised him not to count his chickens before they were hatched. The cloud quickly grew larger and assumed a threatening appearance. Its evolution left little room for doubt that there was a strong wind behind it, and as another strong wind blew from the opposite direction, the two were bound to clash, and we hoped and prayed that nor'easter would get the better of the battle. About 2 miles ahead, we could distinctly see the spray and foam flying into the air. This was a sure sign that the two winds had met and now were fighting for supremacy. To our sorrow, we noticed that the sou'wester gained ground and developed into a heavy storm, and as a precautionary step, we lowered all sail. In a few minutes, we were caught between the two air currents. As both were of nearly equal strength, heavy whirlwinds were formed, but gradually the nor'easter retreated before its opponent. The resulting whirls caused the Tillicum to swing round 3 times in rapid succession, and thereupon the sou'wester enveloped us, and heavy spray drenched the boat from end to end. The strong blow lasted for nearly 2 days, and during this time our boat laid nicely to sea anchor and riding sail. This gave my mate occasion to make different plans for his Christmas dinner. December the 25th proved a beautifully calm day, and our position at noon was a little over 100 miles from Durban, and we had drifted out of sight of land. The unforeseen lengthy passage across the Indian Ocean had worked havoc among our provisions, some of which had run short. Of flour, rice, biscuits, butter, and the like, we had ample, but on the other hand, there was little meat left, and instead of roast beef, plum pudding, and a bottle of champagne, which Mac had promised himself, our last half pound of corned beef had to be shared for dinner, supplemented by Mac's celebrated New Zealand pancake biscuits and butter, and a cup of Lipton Ceylon tea. On the succeeding 2 days, we experienced light variable winds and fine weather. On the 28th, we got becalmed about 3 miles outside Durban Harbour. A large tugboat came out and, on approaching us, slowed down her engine. When within hailing distance, the captain on the bridge bade us good morning and asked where we were from. "Victoria, BC, Canada," I said. "By Jove, you've got a nerve," he ejaculated. "Absolutely necessary to get along in this world," I assured him. "Going into Durban?" was his next query. "Yes," I answered. "What is your charge for towing deep water vessels into port?" "Sixpence a ton," was the reply. "Well, give me your tow line then," I said. "I'll take you at that." "What is your tonnage?" he inquired. "About 3 tons," I replied. "Well, that would hardly be sufficient to pay for a long whiskey and soda," the master of the tugboat calculated, and this ended our conversation. Thereupon, the tug steamed out to sea to look for more profitable business. However, we did not have to wait long when a small launch came up and towed us in. Durban, or Port Natal, as it is sometimes called, was full of vessels of all nations, being very busy at that time. We had difficulty in finding sufficient wharf room to tie even the tillicum up. Having looked around for a while, we succeeded in squeezing in between 2 large vessels and made fast to the pier. Owing to the smallness of our boat, the customs had taken no notice of her on coming in. When I reported our arrival at headquarters, the tillicum was freed from all obligations pertaining to deep-water vessels. While on my cruise, I had been kindly admitted as an honorary member to many yacht clubs. I took about 12 of these membership cards and introduced myself to some of the leading Durban yachtsmen. These at once took matters in hand and were good enough to attend to all our needs. A spacious drill hall was placed at my disposal for exhibiting the tillicum. On the same afternoon, the boat was lifted out of the water and transported there. Soon after our arrival at Durban, I received very sad news from Auckland. My former mate, Mr. Buckridge, had lost his life in the renewed attempt to sail his yawl, Kiora, to England. His companion experienced a very bad time and hard struggles, but he had contrived to regain the coast of New Zealand. Thus, what I had foreseen had happened. Buckridge had undertaken too great a task. He was a genial and a jolly good fellow. May his unlucky fate be a warning to all to thoroughly test their abilities before undertaking a similar venture on the high seas. As it was, my first visit to South Africa, I did not think that anybody knew me there, in which, however, I was mistaken. Whenever the boat was to be taken out of the water, I had made it a point to employ the services of a good man to lead the work. My reason was that onlookers, of whom there were always very many, would ask me all sorts of questions, which made it impossible for me to devote proper attention to the transportation. But I was always present incognito among the spectators to keep an eye on the boat. On this occasion, as in other places, I enjoyed immensely listening to arguments and surmises brought forward with regard to my own person. "Where is the captain of this little thing?" somebody asked. "He has come all the way from British Columbia in her. I should like to see him." "Rubbish," a sceptic replied. "Came from British Columbia in this nutshell. Never! This man, I tell you, is a fraud." "Yes," another one affirmed. "You know where British Columbia is. He's a liar if he says so." These and similar remarks naturally amused me. Then my attention was drawn to a gentleman, a short distance off, who assured the crowd that these remarks were unjust. "Gentlemen," he said, "I have heard here various observations about this boat and the man who has sailed her. May I tell you that Victoria, BC, has been my home for many years, and I personally was there when this vessel started on a cruise round the world, and furthermore, the captain is a personal friend of mine, although I have not seen him here as yet. You may safely believe that he has done the voyage in this boat, which is in reality an Indian canoe. Anybody with eyes in his head may convince himself of that fact." The speaker evidently was annoyed by these utterances in a much greater degree than myself. Stepping up closer, I recognized him and said, "Oh, thank you, Mr. Irvin Ray, for taking a poor orphan's part." Mr. Ray and I had been intimate friends in Victoria for several years, and it certainly was a surprise to both of us to meet again under such circumstances. I remained a fortnight at Durban and was honoured by splendid receptions from clubs and individuals of prominence. Unfortunately, Father Mac contracted the golden diamond fever and left me to become a millionaire. My old Victoria friend, Mr. Ray, held a position with the South African Railroad at Pretoria. He had come to Durban only to spend the Christmas and New Year festivals and was now anxious that I should accompany him home. I agreed, having an inclination myself to see something of the interior. And so the Tillicum was entrained and made the journey via Pietermaritzburg across the High Drakens Mountains to Johannesburg and Pretoria, dropping anchor there for some time. At Pietermaritzburg, the capital of Natal, I stopped over for a few days and thereafter proceeded to Johannesburg. The war had come to a close only a comparatively short time since, and many places along the railway in Natal and in the Transvaal still bore traces of the devastation it had left in its track. The first impression I received was at Colenso, near the Tugela River, where a burial ground was fenced in and beautifully decorated with flowers. Amidst many graves, where British officers and soldiers had found their last resting place, there was a stone erected to the memory of a young officer, the son of Field Marshal Lord Roberts, whose bravery will be remembered for many generations to come. A little later, the train crossed the Tugela River and stopped for a few minutes at Colenso. Thereafter, we passed through Ladysmith and across the border into the Transvaal. Here and there, other burial grounds were visible, farmsteads and guardhouses in ruins and fencing wires covered with all sorts of tin cans which had served to give alarm of the approaching enemy. Arriving at Johannesburg, the Tillicum was placed on exhibition in the Wanderer's Grounds. My boat was the first deep-sea vessel that had ever come to that city, and therefore she attracted very large crowds. A visitor told me that he had followed the call of the sea for some time in his younger years, but had then quit and was now the proprietor of a gold mine. He congratulated me on having established a world's record. "I beg your pardon, sir," I said. "My record has not yet been completed, and it will not be until I have crossed the Atlantic." "Oh, quite so," the visitor assented, "but it is a different record I am referring to. We are here about 6,000 feet above sea level, and I feel pretty sure that no other deep-sea vessel has ever reached such an altitude." Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.